Hi, Nashville. My name is Maria. I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. I came into this program on the 13th of April, 1985. I just celebrated 32 years, April 13th, and I hope I stay forever grateful for that. Thank you, God. My sponsor, actually, I just got a new sponsor. I've had my new sponsor for less than a week, and but I've been sponsored every day since I came in for the newcomers. Don't think you can wait 32 years to get a sponsor. My sponsor's name is Mary Jo. She lives in Norman, Oklahoma, and my home group is the Stepped Up Group in Westchester, California, which is in L.A. It's right by LAX. So if you ever fly into the airport and you're by the airport on a Thursday night at 8 o'clock, call central office and we'll make sure we come and get you and bring you to our meeting. It's a great meeting. It's a step study meeting. And because each meeting is autonomous, we voted that we are allowed to use AA Big Book and AA 12 and 12 if we choose to lead our meeting and to study our steps. There's people that are over, well, it says so in our fifth tradition. It says that we do this by practicing, we carry the message, we do this by practicing the 12 steps of AA ourselves. So that's where you find the 12 steps of AA. The A&A, A&A, as Joe was saying last night, A&A. We have around 100 people at our meeting, but everybody shares because we split into groups. We count off and we split into groups, and we have the blessing of our founder who started that meeting, Vinoy Shah. She found this church when she used to live in Los Angeles by her house that has a bunch of rooms down a breezeway, and they're really generous, and we're really generous with them. We do a church cleanup once a year, and we try to support, buying them new chairs or whatever so that we have use of all those rooms. So we have the leader lead on the step, and then we split into groups. And it's a fabulous meeting. We have spinoff meetings in New York and Australia and all over Los Angeles and now on the east side of Los Angeles, and we got our first Stepped Up daytime meeting now. And so it's a really strong group, and most of us, it takes me anywhere from an hour and 20 minutes to 2 hours to get to my home group. And it takes me about 35 minutes to get home. So that's traffic in LA. And I'm not the one who drives the furthest. A lot of people drive from further away than I live. But because it's such a great meeting and because we use the basic text of the program, the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous that was so generous to give us our program, and a lot of our sharing, we have a lot of recovery there. So if you're new here today, welcome. If you're alcoholics and you're in the room, thank you. You're my idea of an open bar. I'm very happy you're here. I'll have a double shot of that one. I want to thank the committee for asking me to be here. It's an honor and a privilege to be with this amazing group of speakers. And last night was absolutely fantastic. That candlelight thing, I couldn't get that out of my head, just seeing those hands go up and hold that light and have the whole room light up. And when I called home last night, I went through the whole candlelight thing step by step and everything that happened, and I'm sobbing on the phone telling my friend, and then I went through Joe's talk and sobbed through that, and basically I lived last night twice, and that's great. I want to thank Candence, and I want to thank for being my hostess and an amazing, beautiful lady, and I'm so glad we got to meet, and I knew we would be friends from when we first started talking. And I want to thank Nina for picking us up from the airport. So I'm sure I'm forgetting people. I'm looking forward to hearing all the rest of the speakers. I just got to hear Butch 3 weeks ago, and Palmer's an old friend of mine. And Georgia, who's speaking on Sunday morning, she and I are almost related because her ex and my ex were best friends when Georgia got sober. So we've known each other for a long time. I mean, not that anyone in this program has exes, you know. It always works the first time and every time and lasts forever. Because it's meant to be. It's really meant to be. It's God's will. I met him, and he said hi before he turned his back on me, so it's God's will. And I grew up in Los Angeles. I didn't want for anything materially. I had a you know, a normal childhood from the time, you know, till I was about five. When I was about five and a half, my dad created a television show that became the social conscience of the nation, and we moved to Beverly Hills, and, you know, swimming pools, movie stars. And the first thing they did was they went to Europe, and they bought a huge pub mirror. And then they built a huge bar. They knocked out the back wall of the house, and they built a bar so that the whole back of the house was set up like a giant British pub. And one of their businesses was also a wine and beer distribution company, which makes all the alcoholics really happy. And so once a week, we had a delivery guy show up with a keg of beer, and he'd go down in the basement and replace the keg. So there was always fresh beer on tap. And cases of wine and cases of hard liquor, and they had a big wheelie thing that you'd take these big, I don't know if they're gallons or half gallons, but these big bottles, and you turn them upside down on this wheelie thing and attach them, and they brought it back from England, and then you turn the switch one way, and it would fill up a glass bubble, like, and then you turned it the other way, and the shot would come out in the glass. And it was super cool, and I was the bartender, so I loved being the bartender. And I knew everybody's drink. I knew who took two of those. I knew who took one of those. I didn't think, oh, I come from an alcoholic home. There was never, you know, gunfire in the living room or anything like that. One time I woke up after my parents had a party, and I thought there was a squished animal in the living room, but it was somebody's toupee. And another time there was like two little false teeth in the peanut bowl. But other than that, it was just nothing, you know, nothing that unusual. There were a lot of moods in my house. There was a lot of moods in my house. And I never knew when I was going to get in trouble for one thing one week that I didn't get in trouble for the next week. And it was kind of hard to gauge the moods. It was kind of hard to gauge the moods in the morning. I didn't know anything again. I didn't know anything about alcoholism. I was a little kid. Didn't know anything about hangovers. I didn't know anything about the phenomenon of craving or somebody getting antsy, you know, till they utter those immortal words, well, it's 5 o'clock somewhere. And I didn't know anything about that. I was really blessed to go to, you know, a great school, and had you know, it was a pretty great, blessed childhood. I grew up in the world of Nancy Drew, and I wanted to be a detective or Al-Anon. I didn't know that at the time, but I really thought I wanted to be a detective. And so I would walk along Santa Monica Boulevard, and there was a walking path, and then there was like a line of bushes, really high, you know, hedge, 30 foot high, and then there was another little space between the, you know, to the wall. And so I used to make all of my friends, because they all had to play exactly the game that I wanted to play, or else they weren't going to be my friend anymore. I was a controlling, I saw my control from really, really early on. That was one of my first defects of character. And so we would walk behind the bushes, and we would write down everything, well, I would write down everything that people would say on the walking path, because I thought, one of these days I'm going to find somebody that's, you know, confessing to something, and they're going to be guilty, and I'm going to have the proof, and I'm going to have it written down, and I'm going to be able to report them. And I would go to the toy store on the weekends, and I would go up and down. You know, every other kid is like walking up and down the toy store going, oh, I want this, I want that. And I would walk up and down the toy store aisles lurking, looking for shoplifters, because I was going to find the person who was guilty one more time. I wanted to find someone who was guilty of something and basically make them pay. And not only that, not only was I going to report them, but then I would get a lifetime of free toys. And I knew that. So I was a weird kid, in other words. And when I was 6 and a half, my sister was born. It was this thing, and she was in the other room, and there was a German nanny, you know, marching next to her, you know, crib, keeping me away. And I didn't know what it was, but I knew that it was my enemy, because there was something inside of me that said, there isn't enough love to go around. I didn't feel, somehow I felt that that competition, which was something that I also felt at a very young age, and a defect of character that stuck to me for my life, that if she took some of my mom's love, that I was going to get less love. And my mom was a very withholding woman. She was not a what you would call a warm woman. And because I already had that making pay thing, I had vengeance as one of my defects of character, I made her pay for that. And I didn't know it at the time. My mom was also very, she's very self-absorbed, and she's very self-concerned. And so one day my mom made me mad because she said something to my dad that I felt wasn't true and that I felt wasn't fair. And that was another thing I learned here when I got here. And they said, life isn't fair, the only fair is in Pomona. And I was very insulted that they talked to me that way. But she said something, and I said to myself at 6 years old, I am never going to say I love you to my mommy again. And I didn't until I was 19 years old. That's how vengeance I was. And not only that, my vengeance was so deep that, and the parents die when I say this because I can't even imagine going through this, but the nights that my parents were home and not out, you know, doing the 60s, I would say, good night, Daddy, I love you. Good night, Mommy. For years, I did that to my mother. So we were both these two cold beings withholding love for each other. And I don't know what intuitively told me that if you have someone who's really self-obsessed and makes everything about them, the best thing you can do is withhold to punish them. But I knew that at a very young age, and it's a very, very ugly, ugly defect of character that continued to plague me into the program. What I need to tell you is my mom was raised by a woman who was a single mom and gave birth to my mom out of wedlock. And my mom was born in the 30s. Now you can imagine how her mother was treated because she was a single mom, pregnant, a young girl pregnant by a guy she never saw again. And she went to work in a factory to support my mother. And she resented my mother for that. And she resented my mother all her life. And up to a couple weeks before my grandmother died, I heard her call my mother dumb and stupid. So the things that my mom did for me were amazing, given the lack of love that she was shown. And on the other hand, my dad is the most generous, effervescent, lovely man. Anyone, if you guys all met him right now, everyone in this room would think you were his most special friend. He is one of those people that just generates love, and he has charisma, and he has power, and he's funny, and he's a super, super guy. And he's getting a lot older now, and it's hard for me to watch him get older. And that's another thing I'll talk about later, that, you know, at that phase in life, we're getting to watch that and accept that in my dad. Anyway, so here I was. I'm this controlling kid. I'm spying on everybody. I'm looking for people to do guilty things. And, you know, and also that idea that, you know, Nancy Drew always solved the mystery at the end. She always saved the day. And I think it was probably even 4 years into program, I would put myself to sleep with fantasies because I had such low self-worth. I always had to be bigger than life. You know, that's why I love alcoholics, because I can live through them. They're bigger than life, and they're fun, and they're funny, and they're exciting, and they have the courage to do and say things that I don't have the courage to do. You know, I'll go, oh, go jump in that fountain in the middle of the restaurant, you know, and they'll do it, you know? And I'm just like, yes! You know? I am the puppet master. And, they get even later, but, you know, at the time, it feels really good. And so I had all these characteristics of an Al-Anon in training, basically. And when I was six, I was primed for my first hymn. And I met my first hymn, and his mother was Mrs. Partridge. And we used to play Kiss in the Closet, and he would start at one end of the closet, and I would start at the other end of my mom's coat closet, and we'd put Day-Glo cream on our faces, and then we'd feel our way through the coats, and then we'd find each other in the middle, and it was the best feeling in the world. I mean, I pursued that to the gates of insanity or death. Let me tell you, I wanted that feeling, and he used to chase me on the playground, and he'd, you know, scoop his arms when he ran, so he was really cool, and he'd sing, "Come on, baby, light my fire," and still gets me going. I haven't been chased since, but it gets me going to this day. I remember it like it was yesterday. So I went through school, I would get good grades up to the point where my parents said, "You have to get this grade, B minus average." I would maintain B minus average. You know, I talk to my sponsees sometimes about that, they say, "Well, at least I didn't do this. At least I didn't do that." And that's how I live my life. At least. Always at the very least. Never at most. Never go above and beyond. You know, not like we learn here. Take a service commitment. Go above and beyond. Do something unexpected. Add something else to the meeting. Add something else to the convention. You know, go above and beyond. Everything in my life was at least. And I was just bare minimum. Just under the wire. I was 19 years old and I was too young. You know, the bars are 21 in California, but I decided that I was going to go. I'm jumping ahead because I decided I was going to go to this bar and I was going to have myself a one-night stand like all those other, you know, slut puppies out there. And I was going to lower myself to this. And I don't know what made me think I hadn't had a one-night stand before that, but denial is a wonderful thing. And that was another one of my defects of character that I've had my whole life. And turn it on, turn it off. And I went to this bar, and this band was playing, and I could see all the people in the band were, you know, with different girls, and then there was one guy, and he was playing keyboards, and he was lolling his head around, and he was really white, and around his eyes, they were all red, and he could, you know, and he was just like, going back and forth, and I thought, you know, that's the guy for me. And and I went up to him at the bar at the break, and I was, you know, being very sophisticated, right? I'm 19. I'm not even old enough to be in the bar, right? And I'm like, "Can I buy you a drink?" And he said, "I don't drink." I said, "Really? Well, do you smoke weed?" Like, I couldn't figure out why he looked so loaded, you know? So I'm already, you know, "Where were you on the night of June 5th, 1893? You know? And I'm like, "Oh, so do you smoke weed?" And he said, "No, actually, I smashed my truck to the front of the Bank of America on Lancashire 25 days ago and left it there. And I know the cops are going to find me, so I joined AA before they find me so I can say I'm sober." So my brilliant Al-Anon mind thought, "Oh, he doesn't have a car. He needs me." So I offered him a ride home, and thus began our 3.5-year one-night stand. And he was going to AA meetings every day, 2 and 3 times a day. And he was going to the Radford Club, and that was an old Alano club down in the valley in Los Angeles. And they had long-timers there like Alabama Carruthers and Shirali and all these long-timers there. And all I knew was it was a really happy place. And everybody was laughing, and the room felt like it was full of love, and it felt like a family. That's all I knew. It felt like a family, and I wanted to be a part of that. And I sat in these meetings, and I loved Alcoholics Anonymous. I fell in love with, you know, Joe was talking about, you know, the music of the laughter, the music of the people. I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would see these people get up and take their one-year cake, you know, and they'd say, "Last year I was here, and my wife was sitting on that side with her parents, and I was sitting on this side of the room, and, you know, this year and here I am taking my one-year cake, and my wife's here giving it to me, and she's pregnant with a baby," and all that stuff, and I would just weep in these meetings. I would weep in these meetings. I loved it so much. And then I would go home, and I'd say to him, you know, did you ask for that raise? Did you do this? Did you do that? Why are you drinking so much coffee? Your teeth are turning brown. Why did you eat so many chocolate chip cookies that your mother sent you? You know, sugar isn't good for you. You know, what are you doing over there? Why didn't you ask for that raise? Why didn't you, where are you going now? Are you in the bathroom? How long are you going to be in there? How long are you going to be in there? No, I'm serious. Just tell me how long you're going to be in there. Are you going number one or number two? I was completely obsessed with this guy. Completely obsessed. Every waking moment, and right before I opened my eyes, they were talking about that today in the big books, in the step study workshop. You know, right before I opened my eyes, I think, you know, what does he need to do today? What does he need to do today? I didn't know I had no self-worth. I didn't know that alcohol didn't work for me to fix me. I drank and partied. I've drank and partied with my friends. If I got too drunk, I'd go in the bathroom, make myself throw up so I could get back in control. You know, I didn't want to do that. I did Quaaludes once. I broke off all my nails. I said, I'm not going to do that again. I did ecstasy once and just spun around and talked for like 8 hours. I was exhausted. And I didn't know that nothing worked to fix me. I didn't know there was a chemical that was out there that could fix me. All I knew was I have to focus on you, and I have to focus on what you're doing wrong, and I have to tell you what to do, how to chew, how to breathe, how to sleep, how not to snore, how to dress, why I'm going to buy you a new wardrobe, why I need to buy you a new car, why you didn't act right in front of my parents. Everything is about what you're doing wrong and how can I take your soul out of your body one piece at a time by emasculating you, by making you feel less than, by making you hate yourself, because if you hate yourself, you won't leave me. Which explains why I'm single. I didn't have any source of self-worth. I didn't have any source of God-centeredness. I didn't have any source of the 12 traditions functioning in the unity of the group and putting the unity first in a relationship, about there not being an authority in the relationship, and the authority sure as heck isn't me. And it's not even God. It's a loving God. I didn't know anything about bringing love into a relationship. You know, I love this theme, you know, into action. You know, I love the old AA literature that talks about, you know, love is an action. You know, into action, into love. I didn't know anything about bringing love into a relationship. I didn't know about being self-supporting. Financially, yes, but emotionally, spiritually. What am I doing to work my program today? What am I doing so that I don't need you to fill me up? What am I doing to make you not have to be my drink to make me feel okay? To make me feel like all those AA speakers that say, I took that drink and... a sense of ease and comfort that comes at once from that first drink. I don't get that from drinking. But if I can get him to say, I love you in just the right way, at the right moment, or when he's really sick, especially if he's having like stomach problems, he's on the toilet for a long time and he's like really upset about it and he looks at me and goes, sometimes I love you so much I can't even see. Wow. That's like a double shot for me. That's awesome. And it lasts about 5 minutes. And then I need more. Chuck Chamberlain talks about in A New Pair of Glasses that he would sit in his giant chair overlooking the ocean toward Catalina Island off of Los Angeles, and he would look and he would say, if that ocean were alcohol, it still wouldn't be enough. As an Al-Anon, if that ocean were adoration or listening to what I'm saying or validating me or filling me up or fixing me, it would still never be enough. That ocean would never be enough because I need 12 steps, the 12 traditions, the slogans, the concepts, the meeting, the fellowship, the prayer, the meditation, the being of service, the being sponsored, the sponsoring. I need it all. I need it all to fill up this empty space inside to make it enough. To be enough. I don't need to save the day and be Nancy Drew. I don't need to be bigger than life. I don't need to put myself to sleep into the program by a few years by fantasizing about, oh, there's a fire and I'm going to go save everybody in the building. Or I'm going to be struck blind, deaf, and dumb, but I'm still going to go work in an editing room in television and I'm going to create all these fabulous shows even though I can't see them or hear them and I can't talk about them. I'm just going to do this and they're going to go, wow, it's like Tommy. She's amazing. I had that need to be bigger than because I couldn't just be right size like it talks about in the 12 and 12. I just couldn't be human. I just couldn't be this creature that God created, my creator. He's a creative guy. He created all of us with our own unique fingerprints, his signature on us. My creator, I'm now willing you should have all of me, good and bad. He made me good and bad. That's all of me. And he could have created anything he wanted to, and he made me just that way. That means that being human is good enough. So this guy started begging me to go to Al-Anon. Wonder why? And his sponsor was begging me, and they got me a one day at a time in Al-Anon book, and I was so arrogant. One of my other defects of character that started very young, I was so arrogant that I would take my thought for the day book. It's kind of for the alcoholics that don't go to Al-Anon. It's like the 24-hour day book. It's a thought for the day that you read on a daily basis, daily reader. And I had a table, and if let's say I dusted, you know, once a week or whatever, there would be a little thin line of dust, you know, a thin layer of dust. And I would take that book, and I would pick it up from where the mark was, where there was a little bit of dust, and I wouldn't want to crack the binding so then he'd know that I read it, right? Because I was so, it talks about in our literature, that we're arrogant, smug, self-righteous, and dominating. And I'd open up the book to the page, and I would read it. And I didn't know that I was getting help. I didn't know that I was getting help by going to those AA meetings for 3 years with him, over 3 years. I didn't know that I was hearing those principles over and over and over again, like they were talking about today. I had no idea, but it was soaking in. I still wasn't feeling the benefits of it, and I still wouldn't be able to give it away, but something was happening, and I was just so arrogant that I couldn't do anything about it. In the meantime, there was a man who had lied about my age to get me a job as a network executive, the big TV network, and he told him I was 25, and I was only 19 when I went in for the interview. And when I started work, it was a few weeks later, it had been my birthday, it was June, and and so I started work there at 20, and I'm making multi-million dollar deals with big producers and telling, you know, Dick Clark, you know, what to do with his show and this and that, and you know, I'd grown up in television working for my dad, and so now I'm at this network job, and I have an expense account, and that, you know, my boss had said, you know, you just write down dinners and say you're eating with this producer or that producer, which, by the way, when I got to make financial amends later, because my boss, just FYI, if you have the situation, because my boss had said, had signed off on all those expense accounts and knew that I wasn't having dinner and had told me to do it, that was something that I couldn't go back to that network and make a donation to their charity or do whatever, because that would have gotten someone else. It would have injured someone else, gotten him in trouble. So, you know, the last 32 years, I've been able to, you know, buy convention registrations and literature and, you know, whatever it is for newcomers that come in the program to pay those amends back, financial amends. Anyway, so I went to go, I was working at this network, and I was just over my head as far as I'm 20 years old, I'm dating an alcoholic, I don't have a program, I hate myself inside, and I'm also a depressive personality. So I'm getting more and more and more depressed, and he's not fixing it. Because what better person, if I have to need somebody to fix me, that's going to focus on me and tell me that I'm okay and validate me, what better person to pick than a self-absorbed alcoholic, right? That works. Because if he turned around and looked at me, if he left at 9 and showed up at 5, right? There would be no torque. I need to chase that. I need to chase that unhealthy relationship to the gates of insanity or death, right? I have to keep putting that square peg in the round hole. I have to keep, it's going to be different tomorrow. You know, it's like spoiled milk. If you put spoiled milk back in the fridge, tomorrow it's going to be fine, right? And I'm going to pursue that to the gates of insanity or death, right? It's going to be different tomorrow. That's the only way I can keep from looking at myself and how much I hate myself and that I want to die, is if I can stay obsessed with him. And finally, it was too much. And he was rejecting me because I was acting like his mother. And if you act like someone's mother, they're going to turn the relationship platonic. And that's what happened. And so I didn't get that kind of validation from him. And without that kind of validation, I started seeking, if you can't get vodka and your drink's vodka, then you seek scotch. And I started doing things that I didn't believe in. I was raised with morals. I went to church. And I had affairs with people who were involved with other people. And I had an affair with my boss's boss, who was married. And that was my double shot and my triple shot and my quadruple shot. And the days that he would leave his home on the weekends and come meet me to meet me somewhere, that was the day that I felt even better. And if he would leave, and if he would stay overnight and tell his wife he was going out of town and we would go to a hotel, that was even better. I needed more and more and more. I had to up the dosage because nothing was working to fill up this empty space inside that only could be helped by God. And one day I was just done, and I quit my job. I broke up with the guy. I broke up with the other guy. I broke up with the team. And and I stayed in bed, and I was filthy. I had greasy hair marks on my pillow because I hadn't done laundry. I didn't shower. I could barely function. I was really depressed. I couldn't get out of bed. I'd like order pizza and maybe go to Save On at night and, you know, with dark glasses on and get Oreos or something. Cause, you know, I had that also, one of those defects of character was from when I was really young was I also had the superiority inferiority complex. The worse I hated myself, the more, you know, I had to make myself seem like I was bigger. So God forbid I go out at night, you know, I can't go anywhere where people might see me. Don't you know who I am? Nobody knew who I was. I was nobody. But in my mind, you know, so one day I was feeling my ribs where I was going to kill myself. And I didn't know that I had already overdosed on my dad's Valium when I was a teenager, that I, by the grace of God, had woken up on the floor next to, my head was sideways next to my vomit in the bathroom. And if I had been on my back, I would have asphyxiated, and I know people who have. And that was definitely the grace of God. And I was feeling my ribs where I was going to stick the knife again. I didn't remember that I had attempted suicide before. I didn't know I had attempted suicide before. When I was a teenager, I just thought, I don't want to feel anymore. And like somebody said today, I just didn't want to wake up one more day. And so the phone rang, and I hadn't been answering the phone for months now. I had quit the job. I had nobody. Even my parents, who, you know, my father, who never gives up on anybody, said, you know, you're so depressed. You're so depressed to talk to. You're so depressing to talk to. And I was just isolating and cutting everyone off. And the phone rang, and I picked up the phone, and it was this girl who had dated this guy who was in the same band of the other guy that I had been with. And he was trying to stay sober as well via the Valium method, which so she said, I'm going to kill myself. I need you to drive me to a mental institution. Now, if she had called me and said, how are you? I would have said, what? Fine. Exactly. Because my Creator uses all of me, good and bad, the only things that I had left were my defects. I didn't have any assets left. So my arrogance and my smugness and my self-righteousness and my need to know it all and my need to be in charge and my need to be better than you and tell you what to do, he used all those things to save my life. And he's continued to do that in the program. He really doesn't care if he uses my assets or my defects. He really doesn't. So I said, you do not need to go to a mental institution. You need to go to Al-Anon. I will call the office and we will go to a meeting. That was the 13th of April, 1985. And that's how I got here. And by the grace of God, which he continues to bestow upon me, I'm so grateful. He's continued to save my life that way, even in times of trouble in the program. You know, we just have to be willing sometimes, and sometimes I don't even know I'm willing. But he comes to me when I need him, and he will use whatever he can. So I started going to meetings. Now remember, I went to all these AA meetings with my ex, so I knew how to do it. I knew to get a sponsor. I knew to take commitments. I screwed up every commitment. I screwed up the coffee. I screwed up the pamphlets. I screwed anything you could do. I screwed up, and I didn't care. I kept coming back. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I got a sponsor right away. she kept me on one thing all year. She would say, every time I'd say, yeah, but he, yeah, but he, yeah, but he, because I had to go back to that relationship, right, because it was going to work this time. And I'd say, yeah, but he, yeah, but he, yeah, but he, you know, that's all, folks. And she'd say, she was like this tall, and she'd look up at me. She's like 72. I want you to get a piece of paper and make three lines on that piece of paper. And at the top of the first column, I want you to put Maria's responsibilities. And the top of the second column, I want you to put Rick's responsibilities. That was the guy's name. And the top of the third column, I want you to put God's responsibilities. Stay in your own column. That's all she said for a year. I couldn't get 10 months. I couldn't. I was so crazy that I couldn't get a job. I was completely unemployable. I was depressed. I would roll out of bed, throw on sweatpants, and get to the meeting at the Alano Club in Glendale, the Windsor Club, in sweatpants, filthy, barely brushing my teeth or washing my face some days. And I would get to the meeting, and there would be all these alcoholics, like a lot of street alcoholics and newly sober people and, you know, people from the area around there, and they'd be sitting in the Solana Club waiting for the meeting, holding on to themselves, rocking back and forth, and there was me, sitting there holding on to myself, thinking, if I let go of my skin, my skeleton is going to unzip me from the inside and go running screaming down the street. That's how I felt. I was so, every bit of emotion that I had stuffed down, every bit of emotion that I had denied, every bit of fear and self-loathing and all of that stuff that I had avoided by looking at you and staying drunk on you was starting to come up, and it was more than I could handle. So I was hitting 11 meetings a week for my first probably 3 or 4 years. It was absolutely crazy. And I went on, I got another sponsor, and she took me through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did my first 4-column inventory as outlined in the big book, and I got to see my part in things, and I got to see the way that my defects affect me, and they affect the way that I deal with other people, and I affect other people, and what those feelings are. I added my feelings to that 3rd column, affects my, I feel, dot, dot, dot. And I did that 4th column, and I looked at my part in things, and I listed those defects of character, and I listed the way that the defect showed itself. And she had me do my 5th step. It was my 1-year birthday, actually. And she had me come to Palm Springs. She was renting a house. And outside of Palm Springs in the deserts in California, they have those little windmills, you know, those little, like there's thousands of them. And I had heard in AA meetings that they talked about, you know, when you get clean and when you share yourself with God and with yourself and with another human being, you know, it's like a clean wind blows clear through you. And I drove back from Palm Springs and those windmills were going. And I had a Polaroid camera in my car because, you know, Al-Anons always have to be prepared, again, to catch somebody doing something wrong. And I took a Polaroid in my rearview mirror, and I had that Polaroid sitting on my bathroom sink every day for years until the, you know, toothpaste and water and everything got to it and eventually peeled apart. And years later, one of my grand sponsees gave me a picture that she took out in Palm Springs of those windmills, because that was all of that stuff that I had done while I was trying to get that validation out there with those married men and trying to do that, those things to fix me, because I was feeling rejected and I was, oh, my need to be the victim. That's my biggest defect of character. Need to be the victim. It's all his fault, so therefore I'm going to justify everything I'm doing over here. I never have to change if I'm the victim, because every victim needs a villain, and I'm going to always find a villain in the room. And as a result of that, I got pregnant many times. I terminated those pregnancies. That's something I'm not proud of. It's part of my story. And because it didn't matter to me. It just mattered that I needed my fix right then and there. And I was irresponsible, and I was immature, and I needed validation, and I needed to use people, because I use people like the alcoholic uses alcohol. And so I started working the steps. I went on through other sponsorship. I met, you know, my first love in recovery, and he was a speaker, and he was funny, and we were going to trudge the road of happy destiny, like I was saying earlier. It's the law, and you have to stay together, and we didn't. And I got to see people in the Pacific group that were, you know, divorced and their next wife winds up being friends with the ex-wife, and they sit together at the meetings, and everybody's sharing kids, and I got to see relationships, you know, are handled in an adult way, and that people learn here, and people forgive here. I thought, oh, no one's going to speak to me, and you know, it was all part of a growing up process. I got very ill. I was told that I was going to die at a certain point in the program. I wound up very ill for about 4 years on a lot of medication for my thyroid until they could do surgery, and they finally did surgery, and then it grew back, and then they said, well, then this time you have to use the radiation. And so I was very sick for a very long time, very weak and very sick, and the people in the program held me up. And a couple of things happened. I was always hearing people talk about that one of the ways we make amends to people who have passed is we write a letter. Palmer was talking about that this morning too at breakfast, about, you know, if your father liked to play golf, that you could write a letter to your father if he's passed and make your amends on a golf course, or some people go to the beach, or some people go to the cemetery, or whatever it is. And I remember thinking, wow, those stories, they would make me weep. You know, I was so emotional about those things. And then it dawned on me, my parents are still alive. So I decided that I had to start making, I'm quick. I had to start making living amends. You know, the Al-Anon meeting this morning was on living amends. You know, that along with our direct amends, financial amends, there's amends for people who have passed, there's, you know, direct in person, there's if it's going to, you know, harm them, a letter, if there's, you know, this, that. There's all these different kinds of amends. And one of the amends is living amends, which means we do something different. We amend the situation and do it something different. So I called my dad and I said, and he likes to watch TV. I like to watch TV. You know, okay, we have something, you know, that we can, it was an easy conversation. And I said, there's this new show going on and it's about this guy and he's like a spy and he, you know, he works for the government and he, you know, gets all the bad guys and blah, 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 and it's this and that. And my dad said what I knew he would say. You know, oh, it sounds really good and sounds pretty complicated though, but you know what? Sounds like you're going to have to come over to the house and watch it with me and explain the show. And because my mom does not let anyone on the grounds unless you have an invitation. And so she's like the queen. Sometimes you need to have the invitation. And so I said, great. Well, my parents started having me over for dinner. And every week I would go over and we'd have dinner. And then they'd fight about the remote for like 45 minutes and figure out how to get the TV on. And then we would set up the DVR and we would watch that show. And every week I would say at a certain point in the show, we love Jack Bauer. And my dad would say, we love Jack Bauer. And I got to be with my dad. Because I didn't want to have to do it in passing. And I knew he was getting older. I wanted to be with my dad. And as each year of the season went on, as each season went on of the show, the percentage of my mom's drinking and she would get happy or funny was like it used to be that she would be happy or funny and joking like 70% of the time, and then she'd get mean when she was drinking maybe 30% of the time. But 5 or 6 years later into the show, alcohol wasn't working the same for her. And so her martini glass was a glass that was this big. It's like the size of a fish tank where you could pour a full bottle of vodka. That's the martini. It was just vodka. Into this giant martini glass, and she would very carefully carry it to the table in the living room and set it down and then lean over and slurp out the first few drops. And she felt better. But as she got more and more, whatever, repeating herself, or mean, or critical, or whatever, I was sitting in the meeting one day, and where I sit, I have a regular seat where I sit, and where I sit is right in front of the traditions, and I saw for the traditions, and they just looked different to me that night, and it said that we try to encourage and understand our alcoholic relatives. And that little phrase in that one tradition hit me differently than it had ever hit me before, and I thought, I have to encourage and understand my alcoholic relatives because it says so on the sign. Not if she does it my way, not if alcohol is working this way for her, not if alcohol is working that way for her, if she's funny, if she's whatever, if she sends me a letter about, you know, you're a loser and you're obese and you're this and that's why you're always going to be alone and blah, 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 blah. Depending on how the alcohol is hitting her. That's her disease. Me reacting to that or not reacting to that is my disease or my recovery. Those two things have no bearing on each other. They have absolutely no bearing on each other. So one day my mom got really mad at the dining room table, and I don't know, you know, I think we were talking about work. It just wasn't that important. And she stood up, and I was not invited to the house again. And so for a few years, I think I had about 27 years in the program at that time, and for a few years, I was suffering an ego trip about that. You know, it was, I mean, an ego bust about that, because I thought, you know, these people that have time in the program, isn't life supposed to be perfect, and you're supposed to be able to get up there and say, and all your relatives are great, and your kids are doing well, and everybody's a nuclear physicist, and it's all just so great, and, you know, we won the lottery every day, and it's just perfect, and you know what? That's not life. That's not life. And because I follow the speakers around that tell the truth, because I follow the speakers around that the people that I admire in Alcoholics Anonymous and the people I admire in Al-Anon, the ones who don't just say what it was like and what happened, but who say what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And they tell me what it's like now. Yeah, and then my husband was, you know, gazillion decades sober, and he started gambling. We had a gambling problem in our house. Yeah, hey, we had surgery, and, you know, our sex life suffered. You know what? I got a divorce late in program, and now I'm remarried again, and this is what's going on. I heard people who were talking about what's really going on in their lives, and I knew that it was okay, that my mom and I weren't speaking with me having 27 years in the program. And just if you're new here tonight, I'm not saying that cutting people off and just saying I'm not going to speak to you is okay. I'm not endorsing that. It's not the ideal. But I do have to tell you, I had to let go of my mother's voice in my head long before I let go of my mother. If I'm just doing a geographic, if I'm doing an emotional geographic and pushing someone away because I think it's going to fix my life, that's an illusion, and it's a delusion. I have to let go of those voices in my head that say to me, you're a loser, you're obese, you're ugly, you're going to be alone the rest of your life, you don't deserve the good, you've had too much good in your life, therefore God has given you all your e-tickets are used up, you don't get any more. All of those things, don't even try that. Procrastinate. Make up a lie and tell them why you can't do that. So that was a really good experience for me to learn that it was one more phase of detachment. It was one more phase of detachment. And my mother and I do see each other. I just saw her for Mother's Day. We do communicate minimally in between. And I don't believe that it's forever. I really know it's one day at a time. And eventually we will get back together. But for today, we're still kind of inching our way back. And we had a nice Mother's Day, and I didn't get a nasty letter after Mother's Day, which was really the victory. And because that's what I would think. We would get together, and I would think, oh, that was so great, you know, and then I'd get a letter and find out, according to her, it wasn't so great. So that's really good. The other thing that happened, I'm going to talk a little about job stuff. A few years around that time in the program, about 15 years ago, that I realized the parental amends thing, this guy came to me, and he said, I need you to write something for Off-Broadway. I'm going to do an Off-Broadway show, and could you write some sketch comedy for that? And I said, I don't know anything about that. You know, I come from the world of TV. I know nothing about that. And he said, well, you know, blah, blah, blah. I think you'd be right for this. And I said, okay, and I hung up the phone and I thought, okay, the lie started. When somebody offers me a good opportunity, the first thing that happens in my mind is the lie. And I thought, I'm going to say, I went out of town, it took longer than I expected, I'm so sorry I missed the deadline. Like, within a split second, the lie started on why I couldn't get something good in my life. And I didn't call him right away, but I called him a heck of a lot sooner than I would have before. And I went above and beyond. And I think he asked me for 2 or 3 sketches, and I think I sent him like 17 or something, you know, above and beyond. And I went with him, and I saw the show performed, and I got bitten by the theater bug, and I just loved it. I just loved it. And I had done a bunch of exciting TV shows and produced a bunch of shows and got all the awards, and I've done all those things on stage and that, you know, that you see on TV, and that's all really cool, but there's something about the theater that just got me. And the next thing I knew, he said to me, I've got the rights to this film, and I want to write a Broadway musical, and I've been looking for the right book writer for 8 years, and would you want to write this? And I said, well, I don't know how to write a musical. And he said, well, you said you didn't know how to write an off-Broadway sketch show either. But I just remember Elsa Chamberlain talking to somebody and saying, they don't know where you come from. They only know the you that Al-Anon has made you into. And I had my moment, because at that moment he said, and besides, not only would you be perfect for the thing, I know you can do it because you're such a self-starter. It's like, whoa, you've got the wrong number. And, but again, he only knew the me that Al-Anon made me into. And we did this, I wrote this thing, and I showed up and I said, here it is. And I read it to him, and he said, great. And the next thing you know, we started collaborating, and he was showing me how to put music in it and how to write musicals. And we had a producer that came along. I did a third step. At that time I was going through the steps again, and I did a third step, and I was going for a walk, and my phone rang, and it was this guy. And he said, hey, you never sent me those other scripts you were writing. I said, actually, I'm not doing that anymore. I'm doing theater. He goes, oh, really? Well, I'm not doing that anymore. I'm in theater, and I'm going to be in L.A. in 4 days. Do you want to meet on your project? I said, sure. Thank you, God. He came, and he said what my partner said would never happen. I said, well, what's the ideal? My partner said, it doesn't matter. People will say they're going to call you. They won't call you forever. Then you'll run into them in 2 years, and they'll pretend like they don't know you. I was like, okay, but what's the ideal? I don't live that way. What's the ideal? What's the above and beyond? What's God have planned that's above and beyond? And he said, well, the ideal is he's going to say that he wants to give you money to produce this musical before he walks out of the room. And we were walking out of the room, and he said, I want to produce this musical. Let's have a reading. And the next thing you know, we were off and running, and it was so exciting. And I thought, this is unbelievable. And I'm in New York, and I'm walking down Broadway singing on Broadway. You know, I mean, it was this mind trip. I just couldn't believe this was happening. And that man who had been sober when we were working together, he went back to drinking. And then he was hard to get a hold of. And then he was even harder to get a hold of. And then his secretary was making excuses for him. And then he died in his 50s, early 50s, as a direct result of alcoholism. And my partner, my writing partner, said, you know, I've got this other musical. I want you to show up in New York. I want you to walk in front of my apartment at a certain time. I'm going to be walking out of my apartment building with the guy who produced Cats and Evita and Phantom of the Opera and all this other stuff, and this is going to be his last big musical. He's wanted to do this, and we've never had the right script writer. We've had a bunch of writers. I want you to walk down the street at this time, and so you can run into him so I can introduce him to you. I said, okay. I know how to say yes because of this program, because of doing commitments in this program, because of showing up in this program, because of going above and beyond, because of believing that if I say yes to life, no matter what happens, if it works out or if it doesn't work out, boy, I'm having a hell of a journey, and I'm sure enjoying the ride. And I got on a plane, and I flew to New York, and I walked down the street at the exact right time, and he brought out this guy who was getting in the car with his driver, and he introduced me, and he said, oh, you know what, she'd be perfect to write this musical. And he said, oh, lovely to meet you, blah, blah, blah. I got in his car, flew back to London, and the next thing I knew, it was the next week, and he called me, and I couldn't understand a word. He was like, oh, that's real sweet. I was like, like, speak English. Oh, you are speaking English. Oh, okay. And the next thing I know, I wrote this musical, and suddenly, and all these people were there, you know, the Schuberts and the Niederlanders and all the big theater owners, and they said, you know, you got it right this time, it's going to happen, and blah, blah, blah. And that guy died. And then we got another producer, and he died. I have alibis, but... And I've let go of my need to be a victim, so I'm not just adding that up for my story. But I can tell you one thing. Every time I went to a rehearsal for each of those readings, every time we were this close, every time it was almost going to happen, I showed up for rehearsal early. I helped set up the chairs. I helped set up the tables. And when I was finished with the crew who kept saying, no, we're supposed to set this up for you, I was like, no, we're all doing this together. I would say, how do you take your coffee? And I would go downstairs and I'd get them coffee. And after rehearsal was over, when everybody was leaving and the bigwigs were leaving, I would stay and help put away the chairs, put away the tables, and throw away the coffee cups. Because that's what you guys taught me how to do. And as a result of that, I have been having the best time of my life. We still do not have a show that's going to Broadway. We have this guy now, the biggest director, and blah, 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 just attached himself to our show. I'm like, God, I hope he goes to the doctor and gets a checkup. But in the meantime, I've had all these other people hire me to do all this other theater stuff that I'm enjoying. And the last thing that happened was a friend of mine, I had a big surrender. I just kept thinking, you know, okay, this one's dying, that one's dying, this one's dying. You know, it's just like, this isn't happening. And I kept thinking, I do not want to force solutions. I want to live in these principles. I want the results of this program. I've heard, you know, the people in this program that I admire. I've heard their stories, or, you know, Kenna talking about going back to college, or Charlie becoming a writer from working on the book, you know, the book block, you know, lifting books on the whatever. It was like, you know, I've heard those stories. I know that they can happen. I don't want to self-will my life. You know, I really don't. Sure, I would love to get what I want, but really, I would really much rather have what God wants for me. I know it's going to turn out better than me getting what I want. I've tried it too many times. It doesn't work. It really doesn't work. And so I was sitting in a coffee shop. I was just kind of working one morning, and I was working on a project, and this guy walks in, and I didn't have my glasses on, so I can't see very far away. I can see all your faces, but I can't really see the details of them. And I realized that I knew him, and I had worked with him for many years in television many years ago. And I said hi, and he said hi, and I said, oh, what are you doing? And he said, oh, I'm doing this. One of the things he said was the name of a song that I never would have known. This was a Thursday. I never would have known the name of that song except that I had gone to a concert of the person who wrote and performed the song the Sunday before. And I went to that concert because 6 months before, my friend had said, do you want to go to this concert up in Santa Barbara? And I thought, well, why the heck are we going to go to Santa Barbara? She's playing here at the Hollywood Bowl. But okay, I say yes to life. I showed up. I heard the name of that song. He gave me this list of everything he was doing. I was still working. I said, well, it's good to see you. I went back, and 30 seconds later, my mind went, ding. And I said, the name of the song, as in so-and-so, this huge star. And he said, yes. And he said, actually, I'm going to be doing a musical with her. Really? Who's your librettist? Who's going to be writing the script? Are you doing that yourself? He said, well, I just think it's probably a God wink that I ran into you. So this was about 7 months ago, and I had just hit this big surrender, and I was just saying to God, God, I'm willing to become a nursery school teacher. I'm willing to do what it is you want me to do. I don't want to force solutions, but I keep hitting walls in this world. I can't go back to television. I've been gone from it for too long. And, you know, with my age and everything else, and I'm not in that world anymore. I don't know what to do with this, and I really want to pursue my dreams that you gave me, but I don't know how to do it. So there's must be a wall here. And I surrender. You tell me what you want to do to serve you. I know that the only purpose of my program is to fit myself to be of maximum service to God and to my fellows. That's the only purpose for my life on this planet. And I want to do it, and I'm willing to do whatever you tell me to do. And I surrendered, and I thought it was all over. 7 months later, it took that long to get them together with meetings, and I had to do outline after outline after outline after outline. 7 months later, last week, I got to go over to the Star's house. I have to keep it, you know, because we're on tape, and I have to keep it all quiet, but you guys would know. You guys would know who she was, especially in these parts. She's a very big star. And and I got to go over to her house, and she asked me to tell her the story of what I wrote for her. And she listened to me talk for an hour and 40 minutes. And I thought I was going to be out of there in like five. And every time I said, "Do you want less details?" she'd say, no, I'm seeing the whole thing. Hand me another tissue." And she was just laughing, and she was crying, and she was, when the scary part, she went, "Ah!" And it was just awesome. It was just awesome. And that was an amazing, amazing experience. So I might be coming to Nashville quite a bit to work. But anyway, and I have all my peeps from Woman to Woman that I can go to meetings with, which is awesome. But anyway, if you're new here tonight, or if you just are a little empty, I get it. I know sometimes it does get roller coastery in this program, but I can only tell you, I didn't have any dreams when I came in this program, and I didn't have any goals because I was too afraid to want something. And I was too afraid to set a goal because I knew I would procrastinate, and I knew I would fail, and I knew I would never do it. And I had no idea that the dreams that I'm living today were dreams that God had for me. And if you just stick around, just keep coming back, get those steps done, work with a sponsor others, pray, get to your meetings, do those steps as outlined in our literature, you will too be able to live dreams that you never even knew you had. Thanks for letting me share.